This is Doc Stahl with New Books in Jazz. Today we'll be talking to jazz critic and author Kevin Whitehead about his new book, Why Jazz? A Concise Guide, published by Oxford University Press, 2011. In his introduction, Kevin writes, "Jazz is a world of music in itself, encompassing the joyous dust-ups of Dixieland and free jazz, propulsion of Kansas City swing and breakneck virtuosity of bebop, the loud crunch of electric jazz, postmodern fragmentation, nobility, lust, humor, brains and feet, blues, country, rock and roll. It's all there." And Kevin does it in a highly readable question-style call-and-response format, including jazz history, profiles of the jazz legends, and a wonderful discography. Newcomers to jazz, aficionados, musicians, and jazz historians will surely make new and exciting musical connections. Hi, this is Doc Stahl for New Books in Jazz, and I'm just delighted to have Kevin Whitehead talking to me today about his new book, Why Jazz? I really recommend it. I think it's the kind of book
Doc, that breakup thing just happened.
It did. Okay.
I'm sorry. It's,
okay,
you were given the introduction, so I didn't really need to hear it, so I shouldn't have said anything. But
that's okay. Let's make sure we get it right. We'll try again. All right, 3, 2, 1. Hi, my name is Doc Stahl for New Books in Jazz, and we're delighted to have author Kevin Whitehead with us today. His new book, Why Jazz, is a marvelous book talking about the mysteries of Monk and Miles and Mingus, and it's short. Unbelievably short, and yet has a wonderful discography, and it's in a wonderful format. So, Kevin, thanks so much for coming on the show with us.
I'm delighted to be here, and thanks for those kind words.
Oh, it's just a lovely book. I can't wait to get into the discography as well. You have so many wonderful examples in there, and the only thing I lament is that I couldn't go through those examples before we got a chance to talk here. So tell me a little bit about yourself, where you were born, where you grew up, where you went to school, and how you got involved in jazz.
Okay, I was born in New York City, in Greenpoint in Brooklyn in 1952, and I grew up in New York suburbs in Caldwell, New Jersey, and East Northport, Long Island. And I was like a kid who listened to rock and roll music, like everybody else who kind of grew up in the 60s. And I, you know, got a guitar when I was 15 and played, and got an electric bass and played in bands. And went to college in upstate New York at Oswego, State University system. And jazz was just something that was kind of on the periphery for me at that point. John McLaughlin's Mahavishnu work. You there?
Yes, I'm here.
Sorry, there was like a call forwarding beep or something. Sorry. So I saw the Mahavishnu Orchestra, McLaughlin, and also from going to see rock shows at the Fillmore East when I was in high school. One night I went to see Neil Young and Crazy Horse, and the opening act was Miles Davis with one of the last appearances of Wayne Shorter ever made with his band. So I was gradually getting into my consciousness a little bit. And then when I got out of college, I took a job in a record store in Baltimore, and that's when my jazz education really began. Because record store clerks know a lot of things, and they know a lot about obscure records. And I had some people who worked with me who turned me on to a lot of good stuff, you know, starting with the real basics. Kevin, did you ever hear Oliver Nelson's Blues and the Abstract Truth? No. Let me put that on for you so you can hear it, you know. And it's like you just suddenly discover there's this whole world of other music going on. At the same time, my taste in rock music was becoming more radical because I discovered Captain Beefheart, and when once you're into Captain Beefheart, everything else begins to sound tame and predictable. So I started looking around for some other music that had the same kind of impact, and I discovered free improvised music. There was specifically the Music Improvisation Company album, one of the first albums on ECM, with Derek Bailey on guitar and Evan Parker on soprano and tenor saxophones. So I sort of got pulled into jazz from the most extreme kind of improvised music also. Once I got into that stuff, I sort of became curious where it was coming from, and I started to sort of slowly go backwards through jazz history until I got to, you know, the early New Orleans stuff and then started working my way forward again. So it was a nice kind of experience.
Two years
of graduate school, I got a master's at Syracuse in American Literature and Culture. And part of my coursework there was a jazz history course It was a very good course, but by the time I got to the 1970s, I started to feel like I knew as much about the topic as the professor did. So I began to think that maybe writing about music was a possibility for me, because I already knew I could write, but I was sort of in search of a subject. I discovered I was not much of a fiction writer. And so I started writing about jazz. You know, so that was all, I guess, when I was about 27, something like that, but I really got into it. A little bit of a late bloomer, as far as that goes.
Now, your book, Why Jazz, as I mentioned before, it's short. I have jazz histories that are 500, 600 pages long, and your book is short, and it's in a wonderful format, too. Can you tell me a little bit about why you wrote the book, Why Jazz, and the format that you put it into?
I was actually approached by an editor at Oxford University Press about doing this book, and originally it was envisioned as part of a series. Everything You Need to Know About Blank. The first book was about Islam. It came out, I think, about 2002 or 3, and it was a good seller, so they decided to expand the series. And the format of that, those books was it's a question and answer format, very concise. As the person put it to me in an initial phone call, not for dummies, so that you could, try to be, have some real substance there, but try to do it as concisely as possible. And since I've been doing these pieces for National Public Radio from 1987 for this show, Fresh Air, I was already used to kind of condensing my thoughts down into as short a form as was practical without, you know, making things too simplistic. So I felt like that was kind of a good match for me. And after the book was written and submitted, they realized it didn't really fit in with the subject matter of the other books in the series, so they decided to cut it loose. But that's where the format came from.
Yeah, well, I think it really works. It's conversational, and it's really lovely the way it's laid out. Let me go back to something you mentioned, because it's a question I had from your book. When you mentioned Islam, I know you were talking about this other publisher that was producing books in question format. But when
it was the same publisher. It was Oxford. It was just that the book didn't come out as part of that series.
Okay,
I should make clear. Sorry.
Okay. Well, the question I had was, there's one paragraph where you talk about the Crusades and how the contact with the Arabs, that was an influence on European music in terms of their drum signals. I thought that was really interesting.
This is a little tidbit I got from Cuba and its Music by, and I'm blanking on his name right now, so I'm looking at the book on the shelf, Ned Sublet. African drummers who were heard in Spain on a battlefield in one of those periodic skirmishes after the Muslim invasion of Spain, sometime around the year 1086, I think it was. And that some of the North African troops included these sub-Saharan, basically slaves, enslaved peoples, who were drummers who had these sort of drum codes, because it's chaos on the battlefield and visual signals don't necessarily work. So musical signals are sort of a way of kind of communicating over distance, and this sort of plays into what we also know about other kinds of musical codes in drumming from West Africa. So this was sort of like a first inkling of this for European troops. And then subsequently in the Crusades, they found when they were doing battle against Islamic troops in the Mideast that similar systems were being used there. I think that's how this whole kind of signal corps thing kind of works its way into the European military, and gradually out of those signal corps you get military bands that are developed out of the same concepts with drums and then trumpets, bugles, brass instruments, which the Europeans started using for signals also. And out of those military bands, you get 19th century concert bands like John Philip Sousa's, and those bands are part of the influence on the early jazz groups. So it's one of those beautiful things where everything seems to be connected if you trace it far enough back.
Yeah, it was. I got chills reading it. I thought, wow, we're connected farther back than I ever realized in terms of the music connections there. Another thing you wrote, Kevin, is that jazz is full of illusions. I wondered if you could talk about that a little bit.
Well, because it's a reinvention of material, for one thing. And it's like how even before jazz got started, this process of ragging in folk music and in plantation culture in the late 19th century, that you would have this idea that you take a tune, like Turkey in the Straw or whatever, and then you would sort of syncopate its rhythms and paraphrase its melody and make this kind of looser version of it. And then classic ragtime piano music like Scott Joplin's is sort of an attempt to use that same kind of rhythmic energy in a composed music context. So every time you're playing your own version of Turkey in the Straw or whatever, you're sort of alluding to the melody that everybody has in their mind, even as they're aware of how you're changing it up. And this, in jazz history, in terms of the basic repertoire, you have certain tunes that carry a history with them. You know, like when musicians play All the Things You Are, they often include the introduction that Dizzy Gillespie added to that tune in the mid-1940s. Or when somebody plays certain ballads with a Harmon mute, you understand that Miles Davis is one of the references for that whole kind of style that they're doing. And also, this one of the things that really fascinates me is the whole idea of musical quotation, how you quote from one piece of music in the course of another one. Duke Ellington's Black and Tan Fantasy is an example often cited by me and many others, ending with a quotation from the Chopin Funeral March as a way of kind of allowing jazz to kind of call out to other kinds of music and also to sort of drag in the associations. Because when people hear that little bit of Chopin, dun, dun, ba-dum, dun, da, da, dun, da, they know that's funeral music. So it brings a whole other range of associations to it, the way those old bugle calls did, you know.
And that's part of the fun, of course. The more educated you get, the more you can pick those out, and you get that thrill of recognition there, and it ties that tapestry back.
That's actually one of the issues. Issues I try to tackle kind of early in the book, this whole idea of why do I really need to know anything about the history of the music to understand it? Maybe you don't need to, but it will enrich your understanding if you realize that all these things are kind of referring, one piece referring back to another or to certain kind of tendencies in the music.
I had another question, a name that came up that I wasn't aware of, but in the past two interviews I became aware of. Willis Conover, what's his significance in terms of the history of jazz?
Willis Conover was the guy who ran, what was the name of the show? For Voice of America, he was a jazz disc jockey whose programs were broadcast in particular behind the Iron Curtain during the Cold War. And so he was sort of like a conduit of good music for people all over the world. He, I think, became for a lot of jazz fans in Europe and in Asia, he had one of the most recognizable names of any American because he sort of was a broadcaster who played good music and tried to put the music in context so he could kind of educate listeners in what was going on. So he's a really big deal. I think Americans don't know him nearly as much as the older jazz fans, older jazz musicians in Europe and Asia.
But very important in bringing jazz behind the Iron Curtain during the Cold War days.
Yeah, there was already, I mean, jazz had gotten around very, very quickly in the 1920s. I mean, there has been some good research done on this. The Canadian historian Mark Miller has a particularly good book on the subject, whose name I have to look up because it just flew out of my head, as things sometimes do. And some hustling this. Taking Jazz to the World, 1914 to 1929. That's a book that has a lot of good information. And I lived in Holland for a while in 1990, so also I came across some good research there about Dutch musicians playing in Indonesia with Indonesian musicians by the middle of the 1920s. You also had, like, at the Frankfurt Conservatory, there was sort of like a jazz education class by about 1926. You had Sam Wooding's band playing in Russia in the 1920s, and musicians really got around. Buck Clayton played in Shanghai for a while, the trumpet player, in the 1930s, and when he got there, he found out the chefs already knew how to cook soul food because Vallida Snow had already been there and had taught people how to do that stuff. Vallida Snow, a singer and a trumpet player. So it's really amazing the kind of progress that the music made so early on.
And a lot of the scholarship is just coming out. I mean, things that ordinarily we didn't know. Just the fact that jazz players were playing in Eastern Europe and in the Soviet Union and in China in the 20s and 30s.
It's odd that as we get further away from the earliest years of music, we actually know more about it now than we did 30 or 40 years ago. The research on the early years of jazz in particular has been really impressive. I'm thinking books like Lawrence Gushee's Pioneers of Jazz, about the original Creole band that was on the vaudeville circuit in the mid-19-teens. And Thomas Brothers' book, Louis Armstrong's New Orleans, that I'm reading now, also has lots and lots of fascinating information about that period.
Another name that came up in your book, of course, you go over Miles and Monk and Mingus and Ornette Coleman and a host of other names, Louis Armstrong, of course. But Mary Lou Williams, why was she so important in the world of jazz?
Mary Lou Williams, one of the reasons that makes her really important is that she was involved in it early and continued to sort of update her concept over the years. I mean, she made her first recordings in, I think it was 1926, as part of a vaudeville band. Then her husband at the time got a job in Kansas City with Andy Kirk's band, and they moved out there, and before long, Mary Lou Williams was sort of their de facto second pianist. I think Andy Kirk had to overcome a certain amount of skepticism on his own part about a woman being on the road with a band, although my understanding was that she was already traveling with them a fair amount at that time. And she was an excellent piano player and a very good arranger. And when she came to New York in the 1940s, she sort of encouraged a lot of younger musicians, including Thelonious Monk, who kind of lifted the beginning of his tune, Rhythmining, I think it is, from Walking and Swinging, an Andy Kirk chart, where there's one phrase in it, dun 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 bum ba dum ba da 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 da, which is one that Monk made good use of later. And also, she was the first to record music by Herbie Nichols, jazz composer and pianist of the 1950s, who's a particular favorite of mine and of a few other people I know. And later, she would do these concerts where she would present the entire history of jazz played from the piano up until the very modern period. And Cecil Taylor, the avant-garde jazz pianist, was a great fan of Mary Lou Williams, came out and expressed his support. And she said to him once, "We should do a concert together," which was a total disaster, and which was recorded, so you can hear it.
It's uh-huh. Okay.
Because it's like the two concepts don't really gel. It's like listening to two records playing at the same time a little bit, which can be lovely, but it's kind of chaotic and was a bit of a disappointment to Mary Lou Williams. She also did a lot of religious music, a kind of jazz for the church, if you will, in the late 50s and early 60s. Really, really varied, really, really interesting career, and a fantastic piano player also.
One of the things I noticed, I mentioned the name Ornette Coleman, and that seemed to come up a lot in your book, and maybe because of the background you had that you talked about earlier in the interview, what was his significance in jazz?
I think Ornette's thing was about kind of loosening up the relationship between improvisation and a fixed chord scheme. You know, if you have the blues, to take a basic example here, you have three chords that move in kind of a predictable way. And Ornette's idea was, what if in the course of being moved to improvise on the material, you want to depart from that scheme? Then in his case, you shouldn't have to play through it every chorus the same way, with all the chord changes arriving at the same place and every chorus being 12 or 16 bars long. If he has a thought that takes him 13 and a half bars to play, then he should be able to play it, and members of the band should be able to be attentive enough and to adjust their own parts so that everybody kind of stays together. So it was a different kind of way of manipulating the material, but it also, as so many of the avant-garde things do, had its roots in much earlier music, because the blues early on was not necessarily a 12-bar, three-chord form. It could be 8 bars. Somebody might do 10 bars. It might be some of the field hollers, just a kind of a flexible form that expands or contracts according to whatever it is person wants to say. I mean, there was a particular singer in Texas called Texas Alexander. He didn't play the guitar, but he carried one with him in case he ran into a guitar player. And he would do these choruses where he might, you know, instead of singing a four-bar phrase, it might be 5.5 bars or whatever. And this posed particular challenges for the kind of guitar players like Lonnie Johnson who accompanied him on record. It's kind of similar to the challenge that Ornette posed to the musicians who played with him around 1960. I mean, one of the things I find really fascinating about jazz is all those kind of, if you keep looking back through the early period, you find the roots for all sorts of things that come later on. And I guess that's one of the reasons that I've always had a really liberal interpretation of what jazz is. Some people favor a really narrow definition. Mine tends to be rather broad because I'm mindful of these many, many precedents that feed into the diversity of music now. My goodness, that was a long answer. I'll try to make the next one a little bit shorter.
I love it, and I think that's one of the things that your readers will love about your book is that discography in the back where you really took pains to go back and show those older pieces and how we're still drawing from those older pieces. In many cases, people we didn't think were innovators were innovators, and that new players are taking things from them.
You know, a lot of the content in Why Jazz stems from a two-semester jazz history course that I taught 4 years running at the University of Kansas starting in 2004. And I have to give credit to the various chairs of the American Studies Department who allowed me to do that at Kansas. And for every class, basically, I'd be looking through the history, define the pieces of music that really kind of encapsulate the kind of points that I saw were really important. So a lot of those obscure pieces of music are a result of the kind of hunting that I did in putting those classes together at Kansas. And also, I think a lot of the general thrust of the argument, or whatever you want to call it, of the narrative, sort of comes from those classes also. Although White Jazz is much shorter than the content of a two-semester jazz history course.
Why the name Why Jazz?
Well, I thought since it was a book with questions and answers, it should be a question. And I thought because the book was short, the name should be short. But I think that it was Suzanne Ryan, my editor at Oxford, who came up with the title. I don't actually remember. It's possible I did. I don't know. My previous book was called New Dutch Swing, so I thought it was nice that the two books, the titles, you know, add up to 5 words. That seemed like setting a good precedent. So it's a little bit whimsical, you know. Why jazz? Jazz, why bother? You know, I mean, it's a little bit silly as far as that goes, I guess.
So, Kevin, if you're sitting next to somebody in a bar or on the train or on the bus or whatever, and they don't know who you are, and you strike up a conversation, and they find out that you're a jazz critic, and they know nothing about jazz, and they ask you, well, what is jazz, Kevin? What do you tell them?
Yeah, it's African-American improvised music is maybe the shortest version. Music where people do a lot of improvising. I try to avoid those conversations. Well, no, let me put that in a different way. People, when I meet people, they usually don't ask a question, what is jazz? Because usually people have some idea in their head of what it's about. In fact, what more often happens is that people become vaguely apologetic. I'm sorry, I don't listen to jazz, and I want to make it clear to them that I don't judge people's worth according to how much they're into jazz music. I'm more interested in just kind of bringing people to it if they think there might be something in there that they would respond to. The question people usually ask is, what's your favorite jazz record? And that's a question that I dearly hate because it kind of changes from day to day anyway. And I try to resist that kind of the hierarchy in the arts. You know, who's the best musician? Who's the best painter? You know, what's the best painting from Europe? I mean, it's sort of like that kind of question for me. It's just too impossibly broad to answer sensibly.
And everybody has their own ideas. Talk about the jazz wars a little bit. Kind of reminds me of religious wars.
There are these sectarian battles that break out in jazz every once in a while, and it can be a little bit like what's that business in Gulliver's Travels? The big war between people who, the big Indians and the little Indians, the people who crack open a hard-boiled egg from the narrow end or from the wide end, and they have to have a huge dispute about who's correct. In the 1940s, there was one of these battles. It was on the one hand, you had swing music, which some people thought had become too regimented, big band music, like Benny Goodman's, say. You had some of the musicians who came out of Chicago in the 1920s who played in a more loosely improvisational style that was more modeled on the early New Orleans players like Louis Armstrong, who thought that swing music had kind of lost its way, that it had become this sort of almost militarized sort of music. And then also the new music of bebop was coming up in the 1940s, and this was thought to be too abstract, and you couldn't whistle it, and you couldn't dance to it, so there was also some feeling that that music was cut off from the kind of populist roots that jazz had. So you had these sort of battles at that time between the progressives, the beboppers, and the so-called moldy figs, the people who still like the old New Orleans-style improvisation. Some of this was kind of theater. Some of it was just publicity. Sometimes they'd have concerts of, like, you know, Dixieland versus modern kind of a thing, and it was just a way of kind of increasing some interest for the music. Okay, flash forward about 40 years. 1960s, 1970s, you have seen a lot of activity in kind of the jazz avant-garde and kind of freeing up new musical practices and different kinds of ensemble interaction. A lot of it coming out of the musicians from Chicago, associated with the Association for the Advancement of Creative Musicians, people like Anthony Braxton and Mujal Richard Abrams and the Art Ensemble of Chicago. And then in the early 1980s, Wynton Marsalis comes along, this dynamic, excellent trumpet player, very articulate, who basically rejects everything that's been happening for the last 20 years or 15 years and would like to go back to jazz the way it was the minute before Miles Davis got an electric piano. So you can really hear on the first record that Wynton Marsalis makes under his own name that he's really trying to emulate the Miles Davis quintet of the middle 60s. They don't get it exactly right because anachronisms always creep in, and that's not a bad thing. I think those anachronisms are part of the way that the music kind of goes forward. You know, nobody can ever really accurately replicate the music that somebody else made 30 years ago because there's all that other music you've heard that they didn't, that works its way into your music some kind of way. So anyway, in the 80s, then you had this sort of war between the progressives and the so-called young lions, the musicians who favored a more kind of bebop-styled attitude. And as always happens, I think, in these things, it's the conservatives basically always lose these battles because you can't turn back the clock. So eventually, if you look at jazz now, we are not dealing with a narrow definition of jazz at this point. I think I said this in one of the pieces I did for Fresh Air recently, that I think we may be headed toward another one of those periods of intense debates about what exactly jazz is, because things are getting so much looser now. You have musicians who are introducing all sorts of aspects of rock music and even country music, hip-hop, 70s pop, in the case of Esperanza Spalding. I think that that's actually a good thing for the music. You know, I think jazz is very good at absorbing influences from all over the place. I mean, I think improvised music generally is very good for appropriating any sound it hears that it likes. It can figure out a way to work it in. I think one example I use in the book is a musician might hear somebody whistling a tune they heard on the radio. He could be on the bandstand playing that tune back 20 minutes later. You know, you can have things kind of incorporated into music that quickly. Quite amazing, really, you think about it.
It's quite amazing. You mention in your book, you speak a little bit about the relationship of jazz to hip-hop. Do you want to address that real quickly?
Yeah, there's. I think there's a certain kind of rhythms that come out of hip hop, sort of entered into jazz. You can hear it in certain drummers. I remember being at a show at the Jazz Showcase in Chicago, where the master of ceremonies will always get up and give a speech. It always includes some knocks against hip hop and rock music and things like this. Joe Siegel, the impresario. And I remember there was one night where Gene Jackson was the drummer. I don't remember whose band it was with, but he had just been playing some hip hop rhythms about 5 minutes earlier, except Joe didn't recognize that that's what he had been listening to. I mean, I think these things kind of creep in a lot. If you listen to, I think, Greg Osby, the alto saxophonist, there's a lot of the kind of way he places his rhythms in a solo line that has a lot to do with the kind of syncopated rhythms you hear in rap vocals. You also have Jason Moran doing a sort of a prepared piano version of Planet Rock, the early 80s New York rap classic. I mean, it's not surprising that musicians who have grown up since 1980 have some feel of hip-hop in the music, because that's part of what they grew up with. And I think jazz musicians are always responding in some way to the music they grew up with, even if it's not on a conscious level.
You mentioned a couple of cities in your book, New York, of course, and New Orleans, of course, but Chicago comes up a lot. Let's go back in time again. What was the Austin High crowd that you talked about in your book?
The Austin High was a high school in the Chicago suburbs to the west, I think. Now it's inside the city limits. I'm not sure it was then. And a few of the musicians who came out of there, particularly Bud Freeman, tenor saxophonist, and Jimmy McPartland, a cornet player who later married Marion McPartland, were these kind of high school kids who got together almost like garage band musicians, you know, to kind of play improvised stuff. And they would, I guess, ride their bicycles 8 miles downtown at night to hear King Oliver's band play at the Lincoln Gardens. Bud Freeman said later that the doorman there would greet them saying, "I see y'all are here for your music lessons tonight." And they would kind of hang out by the bandstand and sort of try to pick up what they could about the new music. And then they started recording themselves about 1927 and became a big part of this kind of a Dixieland movement that I mentioned of the early 1940s. Bud Freeman worked a lot with Eddie Condon, guitar player from the Chicago suburbs, who was very good at organizing these sort of sessions in the 1930s and 40s, and had his own club in New York, several of them actually, that he was based at, where he would sort of promote this kind of traditional style of music. Although it didn't really sound like music from the 1920s anymore. Their rhythm was much more loose because, again, there are all these other rhythmic developments that had happened in the meantime that crept their way into the music, consciously or unconsciously. I don't think anybody in the 40s was really interested in sounding like 1925 anymore. They just liked to have the spirit of that music.
Another guy you mention in your book that you hear a lot about is Artie Shaw. Why was he such a unique guy?
I think Artie Shaw, I mentioned him because the swing era is a part of jazz that has been covered a lot, you know, so I was looking for a way to kind of deal with it sort of efficiently in the book, so I decided to tell it basically through the story of Benny Goodman and Artie Shaw, these two clarinet players who were sort of leading big band leaders of the late 1930s. But one of the things that's really interesting to me about Shaw was that he was never happy with what he had. If he had a hit, this made him grumpy because then people wanted to hear it, and then he had to play it every night, and then he'd get sick of it, and then it was like, why do I even bother having hits? He was a guy who thought publicity was silly and people should leave him alone, but married three Hollywood stars. I mean, if you want to shun publicity, marrying Lana Turner and then Ava Gardner, maybe those are mistakes, you know, that kind of thing. And he was constantly kind of breaking up his bands and looking for a new concept and putting a new one together. He was often looking for ways to combine a string section with a jazz orchestra, which I think he did rather well at certain times in the early 1940s. He's an excellent clarinet player. And he had also, like many of the big band leaders, had these small groups that might share the bandstand with the big band as kind of a little bit of a break. And he had a particularly interesting one, the Gramercy 5, with a harpsichord in place of piano. A really lovely and distinctive sound. I don't know. There's
had another.
Yeah, sure.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Go ahead, Kevin.
I was just going to say there's a lot more to say about Artie Shaw, but I didn't. You know, it's in response to these questions. Just sometimes I feel that I'm not. I don't want to feel like I'm sliding some aspect of somebody's career. You know.
Well, you covered a lot of different names in very few pages. Anthony Braxton. What? Why was he significant?
Braxton is a really important figure, partly because he became a lightning rod during those the jazz wars of the 1980s. I mean, in the 1970s, Braxton was like one of the great heroes of jazz. You know, he had these very expansive projects. He did these things that sounded almost like a John Philip Sousa's band losing control of itself and kind of running away down a hill. He also made these really beautiful, really intricate kind of quartet and quintet recordings. He did a lot of stuff with unusual instrumentation that might not have a traditional rhythm section. He also wrote very ambitious composed music, including a piece for four orchestras that he convinced his label of the 70s, Arista Records, to record at the time. And in the 80s, Braxton became sort of a focus of criticism for people aligned with Wynton Marsalis, let's say, who felt this is exactly what we're talking about, people who aren't really jazz musicians and should not be considered jazz musicians. Look at Anthony Braxton. He doesn't even really swing that much. And some of them didn't think he swung at all. You know, and my argument is that swinging is great, but conceptualists are also very important. You know, there were people in the 1920s and 30s and 40s who thought that Jelly Roll Morton couldn't swing. I know some people who give me a big argument about that. The piano player Ethan Iverson, he from the Bad Plus, he kind of said, how can you say that Jelly Roll doesn't swing? He's one of the hardest swingers. But some people thought that he didn't, yet we still recognize that Jelly Roll Morton made some amazing contributions to jazz in the 1920s and 30s. So I think Braxton is like a really ambitious thinker. Had a very distinctive kind of saxophone style that drew a bit on some things that Eric Dolphy had been doing in the early 1960s, some very kind of angular melody lines. And he also had an idea that you could have a lot of things going on simultaneously in the music, and people could still kind of sort it out for themselves. A little bit like the Charles Ives principle that you could have, you know, two brass bands playing at once. Well, that can be fun to listen to if you can straighten them out in your head. Braxton's idea was that we are increasingly living in a complicated world where we're bombarded with input. If you can follow four different musical lines from a quartet at the same time, that will teach you something about how to survive in the modern world. So it's just a way of kind of updating jazz to reflect the environment that it comes from, I guess.
Yeah, very interesting. I'm really jumping around here because I have so many questions, Kevin. What was unique
just
about...
Just jumping is fine, that's fine.
What was unique about Kansas City? What was unique about that Basie band, and what was it about Kansas City?
Kansas City, it was sort of the capital of a region where a lot of people did a lot of touring. You know, the so-called territory bands of the 20s and 30s were often based out of Kansas City. The Blue Devils were based in Oklahoma City, but Benny Moten's band and various others that eventually became the Count Basie band was one of the ones from Kansas City. Part of it was that there was this kind of blues tradition that comes from the middle of the country. There was also a few other things that were kind of mixed in. I mean, Arthur Pryor, who was one of the great trombone players from the Sousa band, was based in Kansas City for a while. Sedalia, Missouri, where Scott Joplin was from, is not so very far away. I guess it's a couple hours away now. Not sure what it was then. And because you had a lot of these bands who were sort of traveling a lot in the Southwest, there was a lot of competition. When, say, the Blue Devils from Oklahoma City ran into Benny Moten's band in some little town, and they're both on tour, there might very well be a kind of battle of the bands to see who could beat who. And Benny Moten's record was quite good until they ran into the Blue Devils, and then they kind of got trounced a little bit. And then Benny Moten sort of started hiring one by one musicians away from the Blue Devils until the two bands had basically been combined. Basie had come from back east. He's actually from New Jersey. And he had learned a lot about playing striped piano and about playing jazz organ from Fats Waller, who kind of took him under his wing. Waller was playing organ at a movie house in Harlem, and he noticed that Basie was frequently down in the front row kind of checking him out. So, kid, come here. Show me what you can do, and I'll be back in 10 minutes. And then Fats would go out and get a beer for himself, and then he'd come back and show Basie certain things. So it was, I think Kansas City, the really important thing there was that the Kansas City bands in the early 30s swung harder than the bands back east. And when the Count Basie band gets to New York around 1936, all the New York bands, suddenly there's like a little more spring in their step because they have this example of these musicians from out west, this kind of lighter, more floating beat that was really irresistible to anyone who heard it. So, it's really interesting that you have these very distinct regionalisms that developed in jazz early on. And now that effect is really muted quite a bit because when somebody plays something in one place, everybody elsewhere hears it immediately. You know, and so we have more of a global community in a way than a series of isolated regional scenes.
One of the things at the end of your book, Why Jazz, is where is jazz going? And I think that'd
give a very short answer to that question.
You don't know.
Yeah, nobody knows. You know,
nobody
I remember reading other books, magazine articles, things like that, where people would assert confidently where the music is going, and their arguments seemed very reasonable. Except the music didn't turn out the way they said, because usually somebody unexpected comes along who changes things up, or there's something new that happens in popular music that has an effect on jazz. We just don't really know. Even as I'm saying this, I'm tempted to do this sort of thing, but I think I'll resist making my own predictions. What has happened already is fascinating enough for me. You know, I'd rather talk about what exists than pretending I know what's going to happen.
What about your own evolution? That word has been in the news recently, but what about your own evolution just in terms of your listening tastes and or your appreciation of certain artists? How has that changed? Is there an artist that you, for example, didn't understand or didn't appreciate, and through time you've grown to see them as more complex and compelling than you did before? And what do you listen to now?
I've always listened to a wide variety of jazz since those early years when I got into it. I was always interested in things that were happening in early jazz and certain bebop musicians. And because I was one of those people who defended the so-called avant-garde, I think a lot of people thought that was the only kind of music I was interested in. But I've always, you know, been like a nut for listening to Coleman Hawkins and Duke Ellington, you know, to name two. People, I think what happens is there are certain people you don't pay so much attention to, and then when you go back and listen to them again later, you think, you know, there's some nice stuff there. Whit Marsalis is probably a good example for me. He's someone who he and I have had our differences. And when I was working on Why Jazz, I went back and listened to a bunch of recordings of his from the 90s that either I had not heard or hadn't really paid so much attention to at the time. And there's some very, very good records in there. Uptown Ruler, very nice record. And a few of the pieces that he wrote for Big Band also, I think, are quite nice. Who else? For some reason, Brad Meldow was one of those people I just hadn't really paid so very much attention to him, and listened to a bunch of his stuff when I was working on the book. And I was, yeah, why? You know, you are puzzled sometimes that you haven't been paying more attention to somebody or other. I also recognize that everybody has their blind spots. You know, there's a few musicians who are greatly revered by people I respect whose music doesn't do so very much for me. And I think that's probably more about me than it is about them.
Yeah, well, you do an admirable job.
Not everybody can like everything.
Yeah, I think you do a great job in just speaking about as many diverse musicians as you can, and really explaining why they are unique. And I know you probably get this question a lot, but I'm going to ask you anyway. If somebody is just beginning to appreciate jazz, are there a couple of songs, or are there a couple of collections or specific names that say, this is a must? If you want to get it, you need to start here.
Well, I'm tended to say Kind of Blue because everybody else does, you know. But I think at this point, maybe everybody's heard Kind of Blue a lot. What are records I recommend to people? Let's see. Coltrane Plays the Blues, because I think for a John Coltrane record, it's sort of on the cusp of his quote-unquote avant-garde period, but you can still hear the traditional stuff going in. And the blues is really basic material, so everybody can kind of hear what's going on in that setting. Thelonious Monk plays Duke Ellington. I mean, that was a record that was explicitly made to make Monk's music more intelligible by letting people hear him play on pieces that were familiar to them, like It Don't Mean a Thing If It Ain't Got That Swing. One I mentioned earlier, Oliver Nelson's Blues and the Abstract Truth from 1961, I think it is. Just one of the kind of perfect jazz records.
It's got one of the great names, too.
Yes.
The Blues
also,
and the Abstract Truth is such a compelling name.
No wonder
name.
He did a more Blues and the Abstract Truth. It wasn't quite the same, but, you know, you just can't resist in that case.
Any others?
And I realize all those records are clustered around 1960, and that's kind of a long time ago, but those are ones I kind of point to.
Great.
Yeah. I think one of the things I tried not to do in a way in the book was to try to work in everybody I thought was really good, because I think it's just the reader would get overwhelmed with too many names, you know. So I kind of tried to pick out people who sort of epitomized a movement, you know, and then just tried to tell the story through the music of a few of those people. I mean, I wanted to, I've said this before, but I'll say it again, I wanted to make a book that would be both something that would be informative for novices, people who didn't really know anything about the music, but also I wanted to have enough interesting side discussions and things for people who did know about jazz music already, who would say that's, you know, they would learn some things that they didn't know either. So the musical selections I talk about in the book, they tend to be, some of them are pieces that are very well known that get discussed a lot, like Ellington's Black and Tan Fantasy or Coleman Hawkins' Body and Soul, and some other pieces of music that don't get mentioned so much. One of the musicians I did go out of my way to mention in the chapter on the 80s and the 90s is the clarinet player John Carter from Los Angeles, who I feel is a really important composer who has never quite gotten his due, partly because a lot of his key records have been out of print for a while. But he's someone I really feel passionately about, and I'm hoping that the wheel will turn again and he will come around for more of the good attention that he deserves. I think that generally happens. I mean, I think as more and more people study the music, more and more the kind of overlooked players get kind of re-examined and championed again. You know, it's all part of that same process you mentioned before about how we know more about early jazz now than we did 30 or 40 years ago. You know, you just have so many scholars who are studying the music and so many critics who are voracious listeners that people are always digging up good stuff that may have been forgotten for a while.
Kevin, how do you stay up? I mean, literally. I mean, you must stay up all night just to stay on top of the subject, right?
As we're talking, I'm staring at stacks and stacks of new CDs that have come in over the last month or so. And you try to listen a lot. You try to read around, you know, on the jazz blogs and see what people are talking about. You read the magazines, you know, things like that. But a lot of it is just serendipity, you know. You just dive into recordings and you hear a lot of things that aren't so interesting. And every once in a while you hear something that just leaps out at you, you know. There's things like that are happening all the time. Recently, I've been listening a lot to the pianist Masabumi Kikuchi, a Japanese pianist who lives in New York. It's sort of a strange style. He's sort of tried to eliminate any overt signs of flashy technique from his playing, so it's, he almost gives you the impression that he's approaching the keyboard for the first time, and yet he can play things that are really, really, really beautiful. There's a recent ECM record, one of the drummer Paul Motion's last recordings, with also the bass player Thomas Morgan, where they have a really wonderful kind of interplay. Maybe I should mention some of the places that I write now. I don't know, but the NPR gig, Fresh Air, I've been doing now since 1987, incredibly. In fact, this weekend I'll be going to Philadelphia. They're having a 25th anniversary celebration of the time that the show went national. That is a fantastic gig to have, I have to say. I'm so lucky to have it. The fact that you can both talk about the music and play excerpts, so you can show and tell, that's a great privilege that I'm grateful for all the time. And I also write quite a bit for the eMusic, the download site that has a large amount of editorial content. We get to write about a wide variety of jazz things there. And also do some work for Downbeat. I've started writing for again after a couple of years off. And for an excellent website, Point of Departure, a kind of a jazz web magazine. I've been doing some reviews for it lately.
You get a chance to play music yourself?
Working on a new book also.
I want to ask you about that.
It's about how jazz stories are portrayed in the movies and on television. Mostly in the movies, because there hasn't really been that much jazz on TV. And it's sort of looking at how the movies tell and distort and make up the history of jazz, and how that sort of history of jazz that one gleans from the movies differs from the actual history.
Oh,
so part of it is sort of looking how movies distort history in order to force stories into certain kinds of templates. I don't know. It's really, one of the things that's really fascinating about that to me is that some of the movies that are supposed to be terrible, if you look at them a lot, maybe they're not as bad as all that. You know, there's actually more things going on in them than may be immediately apparent. So that's a great gig. You know?
Yeah, that really sounds like a fascinating project. There's a number of books out there that talk about how history is distorted in film, but I just think your readers would love to hear something like that about how jazz is portrayed. So when is that coming out, Ken?
I'm a long way from being done with that. I'm really just trying to get the proposal together at this point. So I have a sample chapter written, and I'm doing some revisions on that now. And part of it is just looking at these movies so many times that you know what's the date on that calendar on the wall over there. You know, oh, yeah, right, I got that one.
Well,
I like that kind of close reading sort of thing. It sort of plays into my literary training a little bit also.
Well, that just really sounds exciting. Well, Kevin, thanks so much. Just such a joy to talk to you. I've listened to you on NPR, and I just learned so much from your book, Why Jazz, A Concise Guide, published by Oxford University Press. And I think that's going to go out for a number of birthday presents and Christmas presents. It's just a wonderful book. I think your readers are going to love it. And I really appreciate your joining me on New Books in Jazz.
I really, really appreciate your kind words, and I'm glad to talk to you today.
You've been listening to New Books in Jazz with Doc Stoll. Today's interview is with jazz critic, author, educator, Kevin Whitehead, about his new book, Why Jazz, published by Oxford University Press, 2011.